and it seemed so close. I saw your name on a report I picked up from the coroner and looked you up in the phone book.
Not a problem. Sit down.
Thanks. Go ahead with your breakfast. I didn't mean to intrude. He smiled.
I guess I will if you don't mind. What can I do for you?
While James ate his cereal, I laid out Selma's concerns. I take it you knew him personally?
Yeah, I knew Tom. Mean, we weren't real good friends. Him and Selma were older and ran with a different crowd. But everybody in Noda Lake knew Tom. I tell you, his death shook me. I know he's kind of old, but he was like a fixture around here.
Can you tell me how you found him? I know he had a heart attack. I'm just trying to get a feel for what happened.
Well, this was, what, 5, 6 weeks ago. And really nothing unusual. I was cruising 395 when I spotted this vehicle off to the side of the road. Hazard lights were on, and the engine was running, so I pulled in behind. I recognized Tom's pickup. You know, he lives here in the neighborhood, so I see the truck all the time. At first, I thought he might be having engine problems or something like that. Both the doors were locked, but once I got close, I could see him slumped over. I tapped on the window, thinking he'd pulled over and fell asleep at the wheel. I figured the heater was running because the windshield was covered with condensation, windows all cloudy.
How'd you get in?
Well, the window on the driver's side was open a crack. I had a wire in my car and popped the lock with that. I could see he's in trouble. He looked awful, his eyes open, muck in the corners of his mouth.
Was he still alive at that point?
I'm pretty sure he was gone, but I did what I could. I tell you, my hands were shaking so bad I couldn't make him do right. I nearly busted the window, and would have if I hadn't managed to snag the lock when I did. I hauled him down out of the truck onto the side of the road and did CPR right there. I couldn't pick up a heartbeat. His skin was cool to the touch, or at least it seemed like that to me. It was freezing outside, and even with the heater turned on, temperature inside the truck had dropped. You know how it does. I radioed for help, got an ambulance out there as fast as I could, but there was nothing for it. Doc and ER declared him dead on arrival.
You think he knew what was happening and pulled over to the side?
That'd be my guess. He must have had some kind of chest pain, maybe shortness of breath.
Did you happen to see Tom's notebook, black leather, about this big? He thought back for a moment, shaking his head slowly.
No, ma'am, I don't believe so. Of course, I wasn't looking for it. It was in his truck, for sure?
Well, no, but Selma says he kept it with him, and it hasn't turned up yet. I thought maybe you spotted it and turned it into the department.
I'd have probably done that if I'd seen it. I wouldn't want my notes circulating. A lot of it looks like gibberish, but you need 'em when you type up your reports, and if you're called on to testify in court...
Wasn't among his personal items?
The coroner's office would have returned all his clothes and anything he had on him. You know, his watch, contents of his pockets, and like that.
I asked Selma the same thing, and she hasn't seen it. Anyway, we'll keep looking. I appreciate your time. If anything comes to mind, you can reach me through Selma.
I can't imagine there's anything to investigate about him. You couldn't meet a nicer fellow. He's the best. A good man and a good cop.
So I gather. I went back to the motel. I couldn't face another minute of sitting in Tom's den. For all we knew, Tom might have been suffering from a chemical depression. We'd been assuming his problem was situational, but it might not have been. My problem was situational. I was homesick and wanted out. I let myself into the cabin, noting with approval that the room had been done up. The bed was made and the bathroom had been scrubbed, the toilet paper left with a point folded in the first sheet. I sat down at the table and rolled a piece of paper in my Smith Corona. I began to type out an account of the last day's activities. Selma Newquist was just going to have to make her peace with Tom's passing. Death always leaves unfinished business in its wake. Mysteries beyond fathoming, countless unanswered questions amid the detritus of life. All the stories are forgotten. The memories are lost. Hire anyone you want, and you're still never going to find out what a human being is made of. I could sit here and type till I was blue in the face. Tom Newquist was gone, and I suspected no one would ever know what his final moments had been. Chapter 6 I found myself that night in a place called Tiny's Tavern, one of those shit-kicking bars so many small towns seem to spawn. Cecilia had indicated this was a popular hangout for off-duty law enforcement, and I was there trolling as much as anything. I was also avoiding the cabin, with its frigid inside temperatures and depressive lighting. Tiny's had rough blank walls, sawdust on the floor, and a bar with a brass foot rail that stretched the length of the room. As in an old western saloon, there was a long mirror behind the bar with a glittering double image of all the liquor bottles on display. The place was gray with cigarette smoke. The air was overheated and smelled of spilled beer, faulty plumbing, failed deodorant, and cheap cologne. The jukebox was gaudy green and yellow, with tubes of bubbles running up the sides, and stocked with a strange mix of gospel tunes interspersed with country music, the latter dominant. Occasionally a couple would clomp around mechanically on the 10x10 dance floor while the other patrons looked on, calling out encouragement in terms I thought rude. I wasn't sure about the unspoken assumptions in a place like this. A woman alone might look like an easy mark for any guy on the loose. For a weeknight there seemed to be a fair number of unattached fellows in the place, but after an hour on the premises no one seemed to take any particular notice of me. So much for my fantasy of being accosted by cads. I perched on a bar stool, sipping bad beer and shelling peanuts from a brass bowl that might have enjoyed a previous life as a spittoon. There was something satisfactory about tossing shells on the floor, though sometimes I ate the shells too, figuring the fiber was healthy in a diet like mine, burdened as it is with all that cholesterol and fat. The bartender was a guy in his 20s with a shaved head, a dark mustache and beard, and a tattoo of a scorpion on the back of his right hand. I flirted with him mildly just to occupy my time. He seemed to understand there was no serious chance of a wild sexual encounter in his immediate future. I put some quarters in the jukebox. I chatted with the waitress named Alice, who had bright orange hair. I made trips to the ladies' room. I practiced a little balancing trick with a fork and a burnt match. If there were any off-duty cops on the premises, I realized I wouldn't recognize them in their off-duty clothes. At 10, Macon Newquist came in. He was in uniform, moving through the bar at a leisurely pace, checking the crowd for drunks, minors, and any other form of trouble in the making. He spoke to me in passing, but didn't seem inclined to make small talk. Shortly after he left, my idleness paid off when I spotted the civilian clerk from the sheriff's substation. I couldn't for the life of me remember her name. She came in as part of a foursome with a fellow I assumed to be her husband, and another couple, all of them roughly the same age. The four were dressed in a combination of cowboy and ski attire. Boots, jeans, western-cut shirts, down parkas, ski mittens, and knit caps. They found an empty table on the far side of the room. I stared at the clerk with her dark hair cropped short above her ears, dark brown eyes glinting behind her small oval glasses. The other woman was auburn-haired, top-heavy, and pretty, probably plagued with unwanted suggestions about breast reduction surgery. The clerk's hubby held a consultation and then headed in my direction, pausing at the far end of the bar where he ordered a pitcher of beer and four oversized mugs. In the meantime, the women shed their jackets, took up their purses, and left the table, heading toward the ladies' room. I signaled for another beer just to hold my place, and then made a beeline for the facilities myself. My path intersected theirs, and the three of us reached the door at just about the same time. I slowed my pace and allowed the two of them to enter first. The clerk was saying, "Oh, honey, Billy's taken up with that trashy fellow from the video store. You know, the one with the attitude. I don't know what she sees in him unless it's you-know-what. I told her she ought to think a little more of herself." The two continued to talk as they passed through the door and into the first two out of three toilet stalls. I entered the third, and Eves dropped my tiny heart out while the three of us peed in a merry chorus. What the hell was her name? She and her companion discussed Billy's son, Seb, who suffered from genital warts so persistent his penis looked like a pink fleshy pickle, according to someone named Candy, who dumped him forthwith. Three toilets were flushed in succession, and we reassembled at the sink so we could wash our hands. The other woman skipped her personal cleanliness and moved on to the ritual of combing her hair and adjusting her makeup. I was tempted to point out the sign on the wall, urging us to curb the spread of disease, but I realized the warning was intended for tavern employees. Apparently the rest of us were at liberty to contaminate anyone we touched. I tried to set a good example, lathering like a surgeon on the brink of an operation, but the woman didn't follow suit. Miraculously, just then, my brain supplied the clerk's name in a satisfying mental burp. I caught her eye in the mirror and flashed her a smile as she was pulling out paper towels so she could dry her hands. "Aren't you Margaret?" She looked at me blankly and then said, "Oh, hi," without warmth. I couldn't tell if she'd forgotten me or remembered and simply didn't want to be engaged in conversation. Probably the latter. She crumpled the paper towel and pushed it down in the wastebasket. "Kinsey Milhone," I prompted, as if she'd recently inquired. "We met this morning at the office when I was talking to Detective Lamott." I held out my hand, and she was too polite to decline a handshake. She said, "Nice seeing you again. I thought I recognized you the minute you came in, but I couldn't remember where I knew you from." I turned and gave a little wave to the other woman. "Hi, how are you? Kinsey Milhone," I said. "And you're?" She seemed to hesitate, glancing at Margaret. "Erlene." She held her hand out, and I had no choice but to take it, germs and all. "My best friend," Margaret interjected. "Well, isn't that nice?" I said. Erlene's handshake consisted of laying her fingers passively across mine. It was like having a half-pound of cooked linguine placed in your palm for safekeeping. She had a round, pretty face with a button nose and plump lips, a mutant body that was all breasts, with diminishing hips and legs that petered out into tiny feet. She flicked another look at Margaret, clearly picking up on her lack of enthusiasm. I was acting like a salesperson, forcing chit-chat to gain a foothold in the conversation. Telemarketers use this device all the time, as if the rest of us don't know what their phony friendliness is all about. Margaret wasn't fooled. She tucked her bag up against her body and gripped it closely with her arm. "I don't know what you said to Rafer, but he was ticked off all day, and I was the one who had to take the flack." "Really? I'm sorry to hear that. I didn't mean to set him off." "Everything sets him off since Tom passed away. They worked together for years, long before I hired on." "I can see where he'd be upset." I was making myself sick with all this conciliatory bullshit, though it seemed to be having the desired effect. Margaret rolled her eyes. "He'll get over it, I guess, but I wouldn't advise you to cross paths with him if you can help it." "I'll avoid him if possible, but I'm only in town for another couple of days, and I'm not sure where else to get information." I was hoping this would prompt an offer of assistance, but Margaret didn't seem to care. She stood there without a word, forcing me to blunder on. "Why don't I just tell you what I need and maybe you can help? Honestly, I'm not looking for any dirt on Tom Newquist. That's not my intention. I've heard he's a great guy and everybody seems real sorry that he's gone." "Well, that's true," she said grudgingly. "I wasn't sure what to make of your boss. I mean, I could tell he was aggravated, but I couldn't figure out what I'd done." "It's not you in particular. Rafer says Selma's the one stirring up trouble. Says he's sick and tired of her meddling in Tom's affairs." "It's hardly meddling," I said. "She was married to the man and has a legitimate concern."
"About what?"
"She told me Tom was worried about something. He slept badly, he brooded. She kept hoping he'd confide in her, but he never said a word. She wanted to ask him, but she couldn't bring herself to do it. You know how it is. You've got a subject you want to talk about, and you keep trying to find the perfect time to do it." I guess he was prickly, and she was reluctant to irritate him. At any rate, before she could broach the subject, he dropped dead, so now she's stuck. "That still doesn't entitle her to mess around in Tom's business." "Of course not. But she's troubled by the possibility he died with some burden. She's heartsick she didn't barge in when she had the chance. That's why she's hired me."
"Good luck," Margaret said in a tone that really meant she hoped I'd fall in a hole.
"I don't think my chances are good, but I don't blame her for trying. She's hoping to make amends. What's wrong with that? In her place, you'd do the same thing, wouldn't you?" Margaret said, "Well..." I could see she was having trouble marshaling an argument. She was good at put-downs, not so good when it came to defending her position. I was feeling damp from the effort at telling the truth. Lies are always easier because the only thing you risk is getting caught. Once you stoop to the truth, you're screwed because if the other person isn't buying, you've got nothing left to sell. Erlene was watching us like a spectator at a tennis match. Her bright blue eyes darted with interest between my face and Margaret's. I really couldn't tell whose side she was on, but I decided to pull her in. "What do you think, Erlene? What would you do in Selma's place?"
Same thing, I guess. I can see your point.
She flicked a look at Margaret. You said yourself Tom was a bear the last few weeks before he passed.
She looked back at me, hooking a thumb in Margaret's direction.
She thought he was going through the change. You know, moody and short-tempered.
Erlene!
Well, it's the truth.
Of course it's true, but that doesn't mean it bears repeating in the ladies' room.
This from the woman discussing someone's genital warts.
Do you have any idea what was bothering him? I asked.
Margaret was indignant.
I most certainly do not, and I have to tell you I think she'd be better off letting sleeping dogs lie. If he'd wanted her to know, he'd have told her, so it's really none of her concern. Even if he was crabby and hard to get along with, that's hardly a crime.
But who'd know? Who should I be talking to if not Rafer?
Erlene raised her hand.
Wouldn't hurt to ask Hatch.
Would you butt out? Margaret snapped.
Who's Hatch? I asked Erlene.
Hatch is her husband. He's sitting right out there, she said, pointing toward the bar.
Margaret snorted.
He won't help, and I give you odds Wayne won't either. Wayne hasn't worked for Tom in years, so what's he know about anything?
Hatch worked for Tom? I said to Margaret.
Uh-huh. Both him and Wayne are sheriff's deputies. Only Wayne covers Worley Township, and Hatch is working days down here.
It couldn't do any harm, I said.
Margaret thought about it and then frowned.
I don't guess I can stop you, but it's a waste of time if you ask me.
The three of us left the ladies' room together.
I'll grab my beer and be right back, I said.
I hustled my butt over to the bar to get my things.
I figured in my absence, Margaret could go to work on her husband, thus advancing my case.
I grabbed my beer mug and jacket and moved over to their table, watching as Hatch dutifully scrounged up an extra chair from a table nearby. I went through another round of introductions, trying to seem winsome as I shook hands with both men.
Winsome is not a quality I normally project.
Did Margaret tell you what I was up to?
Hatch said.
Yes, ma'am.
He was a big, rangy man with a thatch of blonde hair shorn close along the sides. His face was bony, all jaw and cheekbones, with a big, bumpy nose. His ears stuck out like handles on a vase.
Erlene's husband, Wayne, took a swig of beer and put the mug down with a tap.
End of Disc 2. Disc 3.
Erlene's husband, Wayne, took a swig of beer and put the mug down with a tap. He was dark-haired with a receding hairline, the hair itself cut short and combed forward. He had the pretty boy handsomeness of a small-time thug. He didn't seem to like me. He avoided my eyes, his attention diverting to other parts of the room. Once in a while he tuned into the conversation, but he made it plain he didn't like the idea of discussing Tom with anyone. Hatch at least seemed friendly, so I focused on him. I understand you knew Tom.
Everybody knew Tom, he said.
Can you tell me a little bit about him? Hatch regarded me uneasily, shaking his head.
You're not going to get me to say anything bad about the man.
Absolutely not. I'm hoping to get a sense of who he was. I never met him myself, so I'm operating in the dark. How long did you know him?
Little over 15 years, since way before I joined the sheriff's department. I'd moved up here from Barstow, and first thing you know, someone broke into my apartment and took my stereo. Tom was the one showed up when I dialed 911.
What was he like?
With regard to what?
Anything. Was he smart? Was he funny? Was he a hang-loose kind of guy?
Hatch tilted his head, allowing one shoulder to creep up toward his ear.
I'd say Tom was a good cop, first, last, and always. You just about couldn't separate the man from the job. He was smart, for sure, and he played by the book.
Someone who didn't bend the rules, I said, repeating the coroner's comment.
Yeah, right. You know, little things, he might try to give a guy a break. But high-ticket crime, he was a strictly law-and-order type. All this victim stuff you see nowadays cut no ice with him. He believed you're accountable, and there's no two ways about it.
He took a hard line on that, and I think he was right. Small town like this, somebody breaks the law, you might have dated their sister, or they lived down the street from you way back when.
In Tom's mind, it wasn't personal. He wasn't mean or anything like that. Business was just business, and you had to respect him for his attitude.
Can you give me an example?
I can't think of one offhand. What about you, Wayne? You know what I'm saying? What's the kind of thing Tom did?
Wayne shook his head.
Hey, Hatch, this is your party. By me.
Hatch scratched at his chin, pulling at the flesh underneath.
Well, now here's one I remember, and this is pretty typical, I'd say. We had this good old boy named Sonny Gelson. Remember him, hun? This was maybe 5, 6 years ago, I guess. He used to live over by Winona in a big old falling-down house.
He didn't wait for a response, but I could see Margaret nod as her husband went on.
His wife shot him one night by mistake. She thought he was an intruder and pumped a big hole in his chest. About 6 months before, she'd reported a prowler, and Sonny got her a Smith & Wesson. So one night he's out of town, and she's home by herself. She hears someone in the downstairs hall, pulls the gun out of a drawer, and pops the guy as he comes in. Problem was, the gun misfired and blew up in her hand. Sonny'd packed the reload himself, and I guess he'd done it wrong. Or that's what it looked like, at any rate. Bullet still exited the gun and hit him smack in the chest. I think he died before Judy could even dial 911. Meantime, Judy's got a handful of fragments, and she's bleeding all over everywhere. See, now here's the point. Tom got it in his head that this is premeditated murder. He's convinced the whole thing's a setup. So here's Judy Gelson crying her heart out for her terrible mistake. She swears she didn't know it was him. The whole town's up in arms. Everybody out there protesting. D.A. was going to let her plead out and let it go at that. I doubt she'd have served time because her record was clean. Saved the county a ton of money, plus a lot of bad press. Tom just kept digging, and pretty soon he comes up with this hefty insurance policy. Turns out Judy had a lover, and the two of them concocted this plan to get rid of her husband, take the money and run. She's the one jimmied the cartridge with an overload of fast powder, so she'd look like an innocent victim of circumstance herself. Tom's the one nailed her, and he went steady with her once upon a time. She's homecoming queen in high school, and they nearly run off together the night of the senior prom. Cut no ice with him, and that's the point I'm trying to make.
What happened to Judy Gelson?
She's doing 25 to life somewhere. Lover dropped out of sight. In fact, nobody ever figured out who he was. Maybe somebody local with a lot to lose. Tom was always working that one, trying to get a line on the guy. It bugged him to see a fellow get away with anything.
He liked to work old cases?
Everybody does. Always the chance you'll crack one and make a name for yourself. Anyway, it's more than that. It's putting paid to an account. Closure, they call it nowadays, but it amounts to the same thing.
I glanced at Margaret, saying, "That's all Selma wants."
Hat shook his head at the mention of her name. Well, now, Selma, she's something else. I wouldn't want to say anything bad about her. Tom was crazy about her, worshipped the ground she walked on, and that's no lie.
Margaret chimed in. The rest of us find Selma pretty hard to take.
How so?
Oh, you know, she's easily offended, imagines slights where there's none intended. Tom tried his best to reassure her, but it was never enough. You'd run into the two of them out in public, and he'd always make sure she was included in the conversation, didn't he? She said, turning to Earlene for confirmation. I think he knew people didn't like her, and he wanted her to look good.
That's right. He'd sit there and draw her out. Get her to talking like anybody gave a shit. Everybody liked him and hadn't any use for her.
So in a way, her insecurity was justified, I said.
Earlene laughed. Sure, but if she wasn't so self-centered, people might like her better. Selma's convinced the sun rises and sets in her own hiney bumper, and she had Tom convinced of it, too. He used to jump every time she snapped her fingers. On top of that, she's a social climber, acting like she's so much better than the rest of us. In a town this size, we all tend to socialize. You know, go to the same church, join the same country club. Selma has to be there, right out in front. The woman's tireless, I'll give her that. Ask her to do anything, and she's got it done, just like that.
Earlene's husband, Wayne, had caught my eye more than once in the course of her recital. I thought he was irritated that she was talking to me. Given the fact that Wayne had worked with Tom, I suspected he didn't like his wife being so free with her opinions. He seemed guarded, remote, his eyes pinned on the table while the other three exchanged anecdotes. I couldn't get a fix on the source of his disaffinity. Maybe Rayford had a chat with him and made it clear he didn't want any of his deputies to cooperate with me. Or maybe his attitude reflected the habitual reluctance of a cop to share information, even at the level of gossip and personal opinion. I caught his attention. "What about you, Wayne? Anything you'd care to add?" He smiled, but more to himself than at me.
"Ask me. Them three are doing pretty good."
"You agree with their assessment?"
"Basically. I don't see Tom's marriage as any of our business. What him and Selma worked out is between them."
Earlene tossed a crumpled paper napkin in his direction.
"You old sourpuss," she said.
"You're not going to get me to respond," he replied airily.
"Oh, loosen up. Honest to Pete, you never liked Selma any better than the rest of us, so why not admit it?"
"Say what you want. You're not going to draw me into this."
"Let him be," I said. I was suddenly feeling tired. The combination of tension and smoke-filled air was giving me a headache. I'd asked for general information, and that's what I'd received. It was clear no one was going to offer up much more than that.
"I think I'll head on back to the motel," I said. "Don't go away, Mad. Just go away," Wayne said, smiling.
"Very funny. Ha ha," Earlene said to him.
"We'd best be off, too," Margaret said, glancing at her watch. "Oh, geez. I have to be at work at 8, and look what time it is. 11:45. Earlene reached for her jacket.
"I didn't realize it was that late, and we still have to drop you off at your place."
"We can walk. It's not far," Margaret said.
"Don't be silly. It's no trouble. It's right on our way." The four of them began to gather their belongings, shrugging into their parkas, scraping chairs back as they rose.
"Catch you later," I said.
Various goodbye remarks were made, the yada 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 of superficial social exchange. I watched them depart, and then returned to the bar, where I settled my tab. Alice, the orange-haired waitress, was just taking a break. She pulled up a stool beside me and lit a cigarette. Her eyes were rimmed in black eyeliner, and she had a fringe of thick, dark lashes that had to be false. Bright coral lipstick, a swathe of blusher on each cheek.
"You a cop?"
"I'm a private investigator."
"Well, that explains," she said, blowing smoke to one side. "I heard you're asking around about Tom Newquist."
"Word travels fast."
"Oh, sure. Town this small, there's not much to talk about," she said. "You're barking up the wrong tree with that bunch you were talking to. They're all law enforcement, loyal to their own. You're not going to get anyone to say a bad word about Tom."
"So I discover. You have something to add?"
"Well, I don't know what's been said. I knew him from in here. I knew her somewhat better. I used to run into the two of them at church on occasion."
"I gather she wasn't popular, at least from what I've heard."
"I try not to judge others, but it's hard not to have some opinion. Everybody's down on Selma, and it seems unfair. I just wish she'd quit worrying about those silly teeth of hers."
Alice put a hand to her mouth.
"Have you noticed her doing this? Half the time I can hardly hear what she's saying because she's so busy trying to cover up her mouth."
"Anyway, Tom was great. Don't get me wrong. I grant you Selma's abrasive, but you know what? He got to look good by comparison. He wasn't confrontational. Tom had never dreamed of getting in your face about anything, and why should he? He had Selma to do that. She'd take on anyone, know what I mean? Let her be the bitch. She's the one takes all the heat. She does the work of the relationship while he gets to be Mr. Good Guy, Mr. Nice as Pie. You see what I'm saying?"
"Absolutely."
"It might have suited them fine, but it doesn't seem right to hold her entirely accountable." "I know her type. She's a pussycat at heart. He could have pinned her ears back. He could have raised a big stink and she'd have backed right off. He didn't have the gumption, so why's that her fault?
Seems like the blame should attach equally."
"Interesting," I said.
"Well, you know it's just my reaction. I get sick and tired of hearing everyone trash Selma. Maybe I'm just like her and it cuts too close.
Couples come to these agreements about who does what. I'm not saying they sit down and discuss it, but you can see my point. One might be quiet, the other talkative. Or maybe one's outgoing where the other one's shy. Tom was passive, pure and simple, so why blame her for taking over? You'd have done it yourself."
Selma says he was very preoccupied in the last few weeks. Any idea what it was?
She paused to consider, drawing on her cigarette.
I never thought much about it, but now you mention it, he didn't seem like himself.
Tell you what I'll do. Let me ask around and see if anybody knows anything. It's not like people around here are dishonest or even secretive, but they protect their own.
You're telling me, I said.
I took out a business card and jotted down my home number in Santa Teresa and the motel where I was staying. Alice smiled.
Cecilia Bowden, now there's a piece of work. If that motel gets to you, you can always come to my place. I got plenty of room.
I smiled in return. Thanks for your help. I headed out into the night air. The temperature had dropped, and I could see my breath. After the clouds of smoke in the bar, I wondered if I was simply exhaling the accumulation. The parking lot was only half full, and the lighting just dim enough to generate uneasiness. I took a moment to scan the area. There was no one in sight, though the line of pine trees on the perimeter could have hidden anyone. I shifted my car keys to my right hand and hunched my handbag over my left shoulder as I moved to the rental car and let myself in. I slid under the wheel, slammed the car door, and locked it as quickly as possible, listening to the locks flip down with a feeling of satisfaction. The windshield was milky with condensation, and I wiped myself a clear patch with my bare hand. I turned the key in the ignition, suddenly alerted by the sullen grinding that indicated a low charge on the battery. I tried again, and the engine turned over reluctantly. There was a series of misses, and then the engine died. I sat there, projecting a mental movie in which I'd be forced to return to the bar, whistle up assistance, and finally crawl into bed at some absurd hour after God knows what inconvenience. I caught a flash of headlights in the lane behind me and checked the source in my rearview mirror. A dark panel truck was passing at a slow rate of speed. The driver, in a black ski mask, turned to stare at me. The eye holes in the knit mask were rimmed with white, and the opening for the mouth was thickly bordered with red. The driver and I locked eyes, our gazes meeting in the oblong reflection of the rearview mirror. I could feel my skin prickle, the pores puckering with fear. I thought, male. I thought, white. But I could have been wrong on both counts. Chapter 7. I could hear the crunch of gravel, a dull popping like distant gunfire. The truck slowed and finally came to a halt. I could hear the engine idling against the still night air. I realized I was holding my breath. I wasn't sure what I'd do if the driver got out and approached my car. After an interminable 30 seconds, the truck moved on while I followed its reflection in my rearview mirror. There was no lettering on the side, so I didn't think the vehicle was used for commercial purposes. I turned my head, watching as the panel truck reached the end of the aisle and took a left. There was something unpleasant about being the subject of such scrutiny. I tried starting my car again. "Come on," I said. The engine seemed, if anything, a little less energetic. The panel truck was now passing from right to left along the lane in front of me, the two of us separated by the intervening cars, parked nose to nose with mine. I could see the driver lean forward, the masked face now tilted in my direction. It was the blankness that unnerved me, the shapeless headgear wiping out all features except the eyes and mouth, which stood out in startling relief. Terrorists and bank robbers wore masks like this, not ordinary citizens concerned about frostbite. The panel truck stopped. The black ski mask was fully turned in my direction, the prolonged look intense. I could see that both the eye holes and the mouth hole had been narrowed by big white yarn stitches, with no attempt to disguise the modification. The driver extended a gloved right hand, index finger pointing at me like the barrel of a gun. Two imaginary bullets were fired at me, complete with recoil. I flipped in the bird in return. This brief digital exchange was charged with aggression on his part and defiance on mine. The driver seemed to stiffen, and I wondered if I should have kept my snappy metacarpal retort to myself. In Los Angeles, freeway shootings have been motivated by less. For the first time, I worried he might have a real weapon somewhere down by his feet. I pumped the gas with my foot and turned the key again, uttering a low, urgent sound.
Miraculously, the engine coughed to life. I put the car in neutral and applied pressure on the accelerator, flipping on the headlights while I gunned the engine. The arrow on the voltage indicator leaned repeatedly to the right. I flicked my attention to the panel truck, which was just turning out of the lot at the far end. I released the emergency brake and put the car in reverse. I backed out of the slot, shifted gears, and swung the car into the lane heading in the opposite direction, peering through the dark to see what had happened to the panel truck. I could hear my heart thudding in my head, as if fear had forced the hapless organ up between my ears. I reached the marked exit and eased forward, searching the streets beyond for signs that the panel truck was rounding the block. The street was empty as far as I could see. I patted myself on the chest, a calming gesture designed to comfort and reassure. Nothing had actually happened. Maybe the driver was mistaken, thinking I was an acquaintance and then realizing his error. Someone passing in a panel truck had turned and looked at me, firing symbolically with a pointed index finger and a wiggle of his thumb. I didn't think the incident would make the national news. It wasn't until I was midway through town that I caught a glimpse of the truck falling into line half a block back. I could see now that one headlight was sitting slightly askew, the beam directed downward, like someone with one crossed eye. I checked in all directions, but I could see no other traffic and no pedestrians. At this late hour, the town of Noda Lake was deserted, stores locked for the night with only an occasional cold interior light aglow. Even the gas station was shut down and cloaked in darkness. The street lights washed the empty sidewalks with the chilliest of illumination. Stoplights winked silently from green to red and then to green again. Was this a problem or was it not? I considered my options. My gas gauge showed half a tank. I had plenty of gas to get back to the motel, but I didn't like the idea of someone following me, and I didn't want to try to outrun my pursuer if it came to that. Highway 395 leading out to the Noda Lake cabins represented one long, continuous stretch of darkened road. The few businesses along the highway would be closed for the night, which meant my vulnerability would increase as the countryside around me became less populated. I glanced in the rearview mirror. The panel truck still hung half a block back, matching my speed, a sedate 20 miles an hour. I could feel myself shuddering from some internal chill. I turned on the heater. I was desperate to get warm, desperate for the sight of another human being. Didn't people walk their dogs? Didn't parents dash out for a quart of milk or a croupy child's cough medicine? How about a jogger I could flag down on sight? I wanted the driver of the panel truck to see that I had help. I turned left at the next street and drove on for 3 blocks, eyes pinned to the rearview mirror. Within seconds, the panel truck came around the corner behind me and took up its surveillance. I continued west for 6 blocks and then turned left again. This street paralleled Main, though it was narrower and darker, a quiet residential neighborhood with no house lights showing. Ordinarily, I keep a gun in my briefcase, which is tucked into the well behind the VW's back seat. But this car was a rental, and when I'd left Santa Teresa, I was with Dietz. Why did I need a weapon? The only jeopardy, I imagined, was living in close quarters with an invalid. Given my nature, what scared me was the possibility of emotional claustrophobia, not physical danger. I was checking the rearview mirror compulsively every couple of seconds. The panel truck was still there, with one headlight focused on the street and one on me. I've taken enough self-defense classes to know that women, by nature, have trouble assessing personal peril. If followed on a darkened street, many of us don't know when to take evasive action. We keep waiting for a sign that our instincts are correct. We're reluctant to make a fuss, just in case we're mistaken about the trouble we're in. We're more concerned about the possibility of embarrassing the guy behind us, preferring to do nothing until we're sure he really means to attack. Ask a woman to scream for help, and what you get is a pathetic squeak with no force behind it and no power to dissuade. Oddly, I found myself suffering the same mindset. Maybe the guy in the panel truck was simply on his way home, and I happened to be taking the very path he intended to take all along. On the other hand, if the driver in the truck was trying to psych me out, I didn't want to give him the satisfaction of any overt reaction. I refused to speed up. I refused to play tag. I turned left again, driving at a measured rate as the blocks rolled by. Ahead of me, close to the intersection, was the Noda Lake Civic Center, with the sheriff's headquarters. Next door was the fire department, and next door to that was the police station. I could see the outside lights showing, though I wasn't sure the place was even open this close to midnight. I coasted to a stop and idled the engine with my headlights on. The panel truck rolled up even with my car, and the driver turned, as before, to stare. I could have sworn there was a smile showing through the red-rimmed knit mouth. The driver made no other move, and after a tense moment he drove on. I checked the rear license plate, but it was covered with tape, and no identifying number showed. The truck began to speed up, turned left at the intersection, and disappeared from sight. I felt my insides turning luminous as adrenaline poured through me. I waited a full 5 minutes, though it felt like forever. I studied the street on all sides, craning my head to scan the area behind, lest someone approach on foot. I was afraid to shut down my engine, worried I wouldn't be able to get the car started again. I squeezed my hands between my knees, trying to warm my fingers. The feeling of apprehension was as palpable as a fever, racking my frame. I caught a glimpse of headlights behind me again, and when I checked the rearview mirror, I saw a vehicle come slowly around the corner. I made a sound in my throat and leaned on the horn. A howling blare filled the night. The second vehicle eased up beside me, and I could see now that it was James Tennyson, the CHP officer, in his patrol car. He recognized my face and rolled down the window on the driver's side. "You okay?" he mouthed. I pressed a button on the console and opened the window on the passenger side of my car. "Something I can help you with?" he asked. "Someone's been following me. I didn't know what else to do but come here and honk." "Hang on," he said. He spotted a parking place across the street and pulled his patrol car over to the stretch of empty curb. He left his vehicle running while he crossed the street. He walked around to my side of the car and hunkered so we could talk face to face. "What's the story?" I explained the situation, trying not to distort or exaggerate. I wasn't sure how to convince him of the alarm I'd felt, but he seemed to accept my account without any attempt to dismiss my panic as foolish or unwarranted. He was in his 20s, by my guess, and I suspected I'd seen more in the way of personal combat than he had. Still, he was a cop in uniform, and the sight of him was reassuring. He was earnest, polite, with that fair, unlined face, and all the innocence of youth.
"Well, I can see where that'd worry you. It seems creepy to me, too," he said. "Might have been a guy sitting in the bar. Sometimes the fellows around here get kind of weird when they drink. Sounds like he was waiting for you to come out to the parking lot."
I thought so, too.
"You didn't notice anybody in tinies staring at you?"
"Not at all," I said.
"Well, he probably didn't mean any harm, even if he scared you some."
"What about the truck? There couldn't be that many black panel trucks in a town this size."
"I haven't seen it, but I've been cruising the highway south of town. I was passing the intersection when I caught a glimpse of your headlights, so I doubled back. Thought you might be having car trouble, but I wasn't sure."
He tilted his head in the direction of the police station.
"They're locked up for the night. You want me to see you home? I'd be happy to."
"Please," I said. He escorted me the 6 miles to the motel, driving ahead of me so I could keep my gaze fixed on the side of his patrol car. There was no sign of the panel truck. Once at the Noda Lake cabins, we parked side by side, and he walked me to the cabin, waiting while I unlocked the door and flipped on the light inside. I intended to check the premises, but he held out an arm like the captain of the grade school safety patrol.
"Let me do this."
"Great. It's all yours," I said. I make no big deal about these things. I'm a strong, independent woman, not an idiot. I know when it's time to turn the task over to a cop. Someone with a gun, a nightstick, a pair of handcuffs, and a paycheck. He did a cursory inspection while I followed close on his heels, feeling like a cartoon character with slightly quaking knees. If a mouse had jumped out, I'd have shrieked like a fool. He glanced in the closet, behind the bathroom door. He moved the shower curtain aside, got down on his hands and knees, and looked under the bed. He didn't seem any more impressed with the place than I'd been.
"Never been inside one of these before." I believe I'd take a pass when it came right down to it.
Doesn't Miss Bowden believe in heat?
I guess not.
He got to his feet and brushed the soot from his knees.
What kind of money does she get for this?
$30 a night.
That much?
He shook his head with amazement. He made sure the windows were secured. While I waited in the cabin, he made a circuit of the place outside, using his flashlight beam to cut through the dark. He came back to the door.
Looks clear to me.
Let's hope. He let his gaze settle on my face.
I can take you somewhere else if you'd prefer. We got motels in the heart of town if you think you'd feel safer. You'd be warmer, too.
I considered it briefly. I was both keyed up and exhausted. Moving at this hour would be a pain in the ass. This is fine, I said. I didn't see any sign of the truck on the way out. Maybe it was just a practical joke.
I wouldn't count on that. World's full of freaks. You don't want to take something like this lightly. You might want to talk to the police in the morning and file a report. Wouldn't hurt to lay the groundwork in case something comes up again.
Good point. I'll do that.
You have a flashlight? Why don't you take this tonight, and you can return it to me in the morning. I got another in the car. You'll feel better if you have a weapon.
I took the flashlight, hefting the substantial weight of it in my hand.
You could really hurt somebody if you whacked him up the side of the head. I'd seen scalps laid wide open when the edge hit just right.
I felt like asking for his nightstick and his radio, but I didn't want to leave him denuded of equipment. I held up the flashlight.
Thanks. I'll drop it off to you first thing. No hurry.
Once he was gone, I locked the door and then went through the cabin carefully, doing just as he'd done. I made sure the windows were locked, looked under every piece of furniture, in closets, behind curtains. I turned the lights out and let my eyes adjust to the dark, then moved from window to window, eyeing the exterior.
The black wasn't absolute. There was a moon up there somewhere, bathing the surrounding woods in a silvery glow. The trunks of the birches and the sycamores shone as pale as ice. The evergreens were dense, shapeless, and compelling against the night landscape.
I should have gone to another motel. I regretted the isolation, wishing that I could find myself safely ensconced in one of the big chains, a Hyatt or a Marriott, one with hundreds of identical rooms and numerous in-house security. In my current situation, I had no phone and no immediate neighbors. The rental car was parked at least 100 yards away, not readily available if I should have to make a hasty exit. I leaned my forehead against the glass. From out the highway, I could catch flashes of light as an occasional car sped by, but none seemed to slow, and none turned into the motel parking area. Times like this, I longed for a husband or a dog, but I never could decide which would be more trouble in the long run. At least husbands don't bark, and tend to start off paper-trained. I remained fully dressed and brushed my teeth in the dark, barely letting the water run as I washed my face. Frequently I paused, listening to the silence. I took my shoes off, but kept them by the side of the bed within easy reach. I crawled under the covers and propped myself against the pillows, flashlight in hand. Twice I got up and looked out the windows, but there was nothing to see. And eventually I felt calm return. I didn't sleep well, but in the early morning light I felt better. I was blessed with a full 3 minutes of hot water before the pipes began to clank. I walked out to the highway into a morning filled with icy sunlight and air clear as glass. I could smell loam and pine needles. There was no sign of the panel truck. Nobody in a ski mask paused to stare at me. I had breakfast at the Rainbow, taking a certain comfort at the mundane nature of the place. I watched the short-order cook, a young black girl, working with remarkable efficiency and concentration. Afterward, I returned to Selma's. Her sister-in-law, Phyllis, was in the kitchen. The two of them were working at the breakfast table, which was covered with paperwork. File folders were spread out, lists of names on legal pads with removable tags attached. I gathered they were determining the seating for some country club event, arguing about who to seat by whom for maximum entertainment and minimum conflict.
"Nope, I wouldn't do that," Phyllis said. "The fellows like each other, but the women don't speak.
Don't you remember that business between Ann Carroll and Joanna?
They're not still mad about that, are they?
Sure are.
Unbelievable.
Well, trust me, you seat them together, you got a war on your hands. I've seen Joanna throw one of those hard dinner rolls at Ann Carroll. She bonked her right in the eye and raised a welt this big.
Selma paused to light a cigarette while she studied the chart.
How about put her at table 13?
Phyllis made a rueful face.
I guess that'd do. I mean, it's dull, but not bad. At least Ann Carroll wouldn't be subject to an attack by flying yeast bread.
Selma looked up at me.
Morning, Kinsey. What's on your plate today? Are you about finished in there?
Almost, I said. I glanced at Phyllis, wondering if this was a subject to be discussed in front of her.
Selma caught my hesitation.
That's fine, go ahead. You don't have to worry about her. She knows all this.
I'm drawing a blank. I don't doubt your story. I'm sure Tom was worried about something. Other people have told me he didn't seem like himself. I just can't find any indication of what was troubling him. Really, I'm no better informed now than when I started. It's frustrating.
I could see the disappointment settle across Selma's face.
It's only been 2 days, she murmured.
Phyllis was frowning slightly, straightening a pile of papers on the table in front of her. I hoped she had something to offer, but she said nothing, so I went on.
Well, that's true, I said, and there's always the chance something will pop up unexpectedly. But so far, there's nothing. I just thought you should know. I can give you a rundown when you have a minute.
I guess you can only do your best, Selma said. Coffee's hot if you want some. I left you a mug alongside that little pitcher of milk over there.
I crossed to the coffee maker and poured myself a cup, taking a quick whiff of the milk before adding it to my coffee.
I debated whether to mention the business with the panel truck, but I couldn't see the point. The two of them were already back at work, and I didn't want to have to deal with their concern or their speculation. I might net myself a little sympathy, but to what end?
See you in a bit, I said.
The two didn't lift their heads. I shrugged to myself and moved into the den. I stood in the doorway while I sipped my coffee, staring at the disarray that still littered the room. I'd been working my way through the mess in an orderly fashion, but the result seemed fragmented. Many jobs were half done, and those I'd completed hadn't netted me anything in the way of hard data. I'd simply proceeded on the assumption that if Tom Newquist was up to something, he had to have left a trace of it somewhere. There were numerous odd lots of paperwork I wasn't sure how to classify. I'd piled much of it on the desk, in an arrangement invisible to the naked eye. I was down to the dregs, and it was hard to know just where to go from here. I'd lost all enthusiasm for the project, which felt dirty and pointless. I did have 6 banker's boxes stacked along one wall. Those contained the files that I'd labeled and grouped. Previous income tax forms, warranties, insurance policies, property valuations, various utility stubs, telephone bills, and credit card receipts. Still no sign of his field notes, but he might have left them at the station. I made a mental note to check with Rafer on that. I set my mug on an empty bookshelf, folded together a fresh banker's box, and began to clear Tom's desk. I placed papers in the box with no particular intention except to tidy the space. I was here as an investigator, not as char in residence. Once I cleared the desk, I felt better. For one thing, I could see now that his blotter was covered with scribbles, doodles, telephone numbers, what looked like case numbers, cartoon dogs and cats in various poses, appointments, names and addresses, drawings of cars with flames shooting from the tailpipes. Some of the numerals had been cast in 3 dimensions, a technique I employed sometimes while I was talking on the phone. Some items of information were boxed in pen. Some were outlined and shaded in strokes of different thicknesses. I pored over the whole of it as though it were hieroglyphic, then panned across the surface item by item. The drawings were much like the one 6th-grade boys seemed to favor in my elementary days. Daggers and blood, guns firing fat bullets at somebody's cartoon head. The only repeat item was a length of thick rope fashioned into a hangman's noose. He'd drawn 2 of those, one with an X'd-out phone number in the center, the second with a series of numbers followed by a question mark. In one corner of the blotter was a hand-drawn calendar for the month of February, the numbers neatly filled in. I did a quick check of the calendar and realized the numbers didn't correspond to February of this year. The first fell on a Sunday, and the last two Saturdays of the month had been X'd out. I paused long enough to make a detailed list of all the telephone and case numbers. Intrigued, I retrieved the file of telephone records from the past 6 months, hoping for a match. I was temporarily sidetracked when I spotted 7 calls to the 805 area code, which covers Santa Teresa County as well as Perdido County to the south and San Luis Obispo County to the north of us. One number I recognized as the Perdido County Sheriff's Department. There were 6 calls to another number, spaced roughly 2 weeks apart. The most recent of these was late January, a few days before his death. On impulse, I picked up the phone and dialed the number. After 3 rings, a machine clicked on, a woman's voice giving the standard, "Sorry, I'm not here right now to receive your call, but if you'll leave your name, number, and a message, I'll be happy to get back to you as soon as I can. Take as long as you need, and remember, wait for the beep." Her voice was throaty and mature, but that was the extent of the information I gleaned. I waited for the beep and then thought better of a message, quietly replacing the handset without saying a word. Maybe she was a friend of Selma's. I'd have to ask when I had the chance. I made a note of the number and went back to work. I tried comparing the numbers on the phone bills with numbers on the blotter, and that netted me a hit. It looked as if someone, I assumed Tom, had completed a call to the number I'd seen X'd out in the center of one noose, though that number had been noted without the 805 area code attached. I tried the number myself, and the call was picked up by a live human being.
"Gramercy, how may I direct your call?"
"Gramercy?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"This is the Gramercy Hotel in downtown Santa Teresa?"
"That's correct."
"Sorry, wrong number." I depressed the plunger and disconnected.
Well, that was odd.
The Gramercy Hotel was a flea-bag establishment down on Lower State Street. Why would the Newquists call them? I circled the number in my notes, adding a question mark, and then I went back to my survey of telephone bills. I could find no other number that seemed significant on the face of it. I placed another banker's box on the desktop and continued packing. At 10, I paused to stretch my legs and did a few squats. I still had the lower cabinets to unload, 2 of which were enclosed by wide doors spanning the width of the bookshelves. I decided to get the worst of it over with. I got down on my hands and knees and began to pull boxes out of the left-hand side. The storage space was so commodious, I had to insert my head and shoulders to reach the far corners. I heaved 2 boxes into view and then sat there on the floor going through the contents. At the top of the second box, I came across 2 blue big-ring loose-leaf binders that looked promising. Apparently, Tom had photocopies of the bulk of the reports in the Sheriff's Department casebooks. This was the log of unsolved crimes kept on active status, though many were years old, copies yellowing. These were the cases detectives reworked any time new information came to light or additional leads came in. I leafed through with interest. This was Nota County crime from the year 1935 to the present. Even reading between the lines, there wasn't much attention paid to the rights of the defendant in the early cases. The notion of victims' rights would have seemed a curious concept in 1942. In those days, the victim had the right to redress in a court of law. These days, a trial isn't about guilt or innocence. It's a battle of wits in which competing attorneys, like intellectual gladiators, test their use of rhetoric. The mark of a good defense attorney is his ability to take any given set of facts and recast them in such a light that, presto changeo, as if by magic, what appeared to be absolute is turned into a frame-up or some elaborate conspiracy on the part of the police or government. Suddenly the perpetrator becomes the victim, and the deceased is all but forgotten in the process.
"Kinsey?"
I jumped. Phyllis was standing in the doorway.
"Shit, you scared me," I said. "I didn't hear you come in."
"I'm sorry. I'm just on my way home. Can I talk to you for a minute?"
"Sure, come on in."
"In private," she added, and then turned on her heel. Chapter 8. I scrambled to my feet and followed her down the hall. Behind us, I could hear Selma chatting with someone on the phone. When we reached the front door, Phyllis opened it and moved out onto the porch. I hesitated and then joined her, stepping to one side as she pulled the door shut behind us. The cold hit like a blast. The sky had turned hazy, with heavy gray clouds sliding.